Very disappointing. Just five? Can we get ten? Can we have... Most human beings, the Shechina B'neihem for machines only applies to ten. The Gemara says by people it goes down to ten, to three, to one. But for machines you have to have ten iPods on a table before there'll be Shechina B'neihem. We need four more. All volunteers? Done. Okay. Now we can start. This week and 2 week part, this week and next week, what I'd like to do is, has a title. It's in some way a summation of different topics that we've done. Not a summary, but a summation. What I'd like to talk about is various things that relate to the nosei of Judaism and modernity. Many of the topics we spoke about, bizmanam, we talked about them, abstract theology. Interesting for those who have abstract theological minds. I think I mentioned 5 months ago that I genuinely believe that abstract theology has a lot of daily implications. At least an understanding, maybe not directly for the individual, doesn't make a difference to, but understanding the world in which we live. And that's more or less what I'd like to summarize in this lengthy two-part exposition. Before I start listing those aspects of modernity, or modern society, which we have to deal with, I'd like to make a comment on the word modernity. To a great extent, and this itself is a modern phenomenon. A modern phenomenon, one of the aspects of modernity that's interesting is that the word modernity is a shevach, is a compliment. It wasn't always true. There were many years in world history where to say that something was the latest was an insult. The true, meaningful things were those things which had long historical ancestries. Sh'al avicha v'yagedcha, that was true. If somebody thought of something now or became the latest fashion, so that in many, many circles would mean that it was inherently either unlikely or undistinguished or in some other way suspect. Part of the philosophy or the culture of modernity today is that things are, by definition, modern things are better than old things. That's true not only in, we're going to talk about philosophy now, but that's true not only in philosophy, that's true in like, that's true in iPhones. I mean, it's true in everything today. The fact is that there are many companies, some of which are exhibited on the table in front of us, which make their living by convincing people to get the latest and the best, even though it's no better than the one before that, but just it must be better because it's new. So it's true in a popular culture manner as well, but it's very much true in terms of intellectual culture. It's common today to have an argument about something, and you can put down an opinion just by saying that it already existed 100 years ago. If an opinion is more than 100 years old, that automatically makes it suspect in modern discourse. I'm not even going to discuss why that's true. I don't even know why it's true. It's one of the interesting things about modern life, but it's first of all something which you have to be aware of and be defensive about. In other words, l'shnei akivunim, you cannot say that something is true simply because it's the latest or it's what people happen to believe in the 20th century. The opposite is true as well. There's nothing necessarily sacrosanct about ideas held in the Middle Ages. Many ideas held in the Middle Ages are really outmoded. But one has to be very, very careful about this. It's not a new thing. It's been going on for years and years and years and years. But it is true that if you realize the pace in which simple truths change today, it has to make you wonder about the doctrine that all modern ideas are necessarily better than ancient ideas. In my short life, there have been major revolutions in what is totally accepted today and was totally unaccepted once. Just this morning I read an article, which is not exactly the major field I want to talk about, but it's an interesting example. In 1962, I know you think that that's really a very, very long time ago, there was a meeting, a mandatory meeting. There's a section in the International Herald Tribune where they report the news from 50 years ago, 75 years ago, and 100 years ago. So this is the piece of news from 50 years ago. There was a mandatory meeting for all students in Vassar College, which is not a college that's run by Yeshiva University or by the Methodist Church of America. It's the bastion of liberal intellectual thought. Basically we're talking about Harvard here for women. There was a mandatory meeting. 50 years ago is a long time, but it's very possible that I might have known some of the, just a little bit older than me, I might have known some of the young women who were at the meeting. Where the Dean of Vassar informed the students that promiscuity is frowned upon in Vassar, and any student caught being promiscuous would be expelled. I don't think Stern College today could expel a student for being promiscuous. But, you know, it was perfectly acceptable, apparently. I'm sure somebody protested. But it was perfectly acceptable for Harvard University to inform at least the women. I assume they didn't tell that to the men. But they could inform the women that you could be thrown out of a university for acting in a manner that the dean thought was inappropriate for young intellectuals. In 50 years, that idea, if some university would say that today, they would be pilloried. They would simply be wiped off the map. That's not, you can maybe do that in yeshiva, but you couldn't possibly do that in any university, even one owned by the Presbyterian Church of America. Could you possibly have a policy like that? Because it would be considered to be unintellectual, unethical, not in keeping with the modern understanding of the freedom of the individual and a person's rights and obligations in an institution of high earning. And just no one would even think of it for a second. You wouldn't even, people in this room, I assume, would think that the university, that university, would not the Yeshiva Tal Etzion, would be off the wall. That's just a small example. I haven't seen this morning, but there's legions of examples where basic ideas about ethics, about morality, about what's right and what's wrong, take euthanasia, which was a joke 25, 30 years ago. I say a joke in other words, you could accuse somebody of, somebody who suggested that you do A, you could simply end the conversation by saying, that's a form of euthanasia. Conversation over. Today, euthanasia is legal in Holland, is practiced, is encouraged in Holland. It's more or less legal in Wisconsin. Not Wisconsin. One of those states where they wear cowboy hats. Wyoming. Wisconsin. One of those. I don't know. Some place east of the Hudson River. It's all a blur to me once you get past the Hudson. And within a few years, it'll be practiced in the United States as well. And you consider it to be like sort of, you consider yourself to be crazy if you deny that a person has the right to kill themselves or to get other people to kill them or to get the government, in Holland the government pays for the procedure. It's part of a health plan. You're guaranteed health. The assumption really is, this is not a joke, the assumption really is that being dead is healthier than being very, very old and suffering. And therefore health plans pay for you to be dead. It's a way of curing your problem. There are two ways to cure a problem. One is to make you strong, and the other one is to turn off the lights. Yeah, but we've solved the health problem that you had. That's just, I mean, these are just, there are endless examples like that. It's true in reproductive ethics, and a lot has to do with medicine, but not only there. So that's a word of warning, that no one should dare. In other words, what I'm going to talk about is why, among certain areas, the fact that it's modern means that it's not good. In certain areas, and what the ideas that we have to pick and choose as to what's true in our culture. Now, the background for our discussion is something I mentioned once, I don't remember when, in one of the topics a few months ago. And I just want to repeat the basic understanding. There's a field in sociology called sociology of knowledge, which is it was developed relatively late. I think in the term, I think, was only invented in the 1940s. The father of sociology of knowledge in the United States is a sociologist named Peter Berger, and who I mentioned in another context because today he's a bar tshuva, today he's a religious individual who writes about religion, but at the time he was just a regular American sociologist, which means he wasn't. And the idea of sociology of knowledge is that just like we dress in a certain manner, I mean, if somebody would walk into this room wearing a a turban, so we'd consider him to be weird. You know, you basically can't do it. You have to take a certain weird personality to have the guts to do something like that. You all dress the same, you talk the same language, you talk the same slang, we eat the same foods. Sociology affects all sorts of things. There's something called sociology of knowledge. So there's a certain, a lot of disagreements among us, but there's certain assumptions about what is, could be true, and certain things are not true, and they are sociologically determined. It's easy to show it historically, but it's true in different societies as well. With 400 years ago, if someone would claim that demons did not exist, it's not that the church would burn them at the stake. It's like a crazy idea. They were real. Those people met them all the time. There's an interesting line in Rav Chasdei Kreskas, to take a Jewish example, where in the last section of his sefer he discusses topics which that doesn't have a definitive answer. Most of the book is about what you have to believe in, what Judaism teaches. The last section is what Judaism maybe teaches. One of the questions is astrology true? So, we have an attitude today that says that primitive people believe in astrology, whereas scientific, rational people do not. In the Middle Ages, the situation was the opposite. So, Rav Chasdei has theological reasons against astrology. He thinks that it's bad for religion. He likes freedom, he likes the Hashgacha Pratis, he doesn't like astrology, so he lists those reasons. But then he says, but on the other hand, I mean, we know it's true, because it's been proven 100 times over. We see it in our daily lives. Everyone knows that the stars affect the way people act. It's just true all over. So therefore, it was a question of religion, of dat umada. His religion was against astrology, and his science was for. But the interesting line was, he says, what can I do? We just... You know, you see it's true. It's Maisim B'choyom, the Galui L'Neged Einein. The Ramban has a similar line in a more extreme case. Astrology is a little bit like up in the sky. But the Ramban has a similar line about the Rambam, where he finally loses patience with the Rambam, who doesn't believe in demons, and doesn't believe in necromancy, and doesn't believe in magic, and doesn't believe in all the other things Ramban believes in. Ramban has a whole long list. Ramban never met a superstition he didn't believe in. And so the Ramban says, you know, it just shows you the obstinacy of these philosophers. That even when, you know, it's like they could deny that day is day. We all know that there are magicians who can do A, B, and C. It's like, you know, my block, I have three of them. And the Rambam, because he's this ideologue and he's stuck in his thoughts, he just ignores the Metzius. That was really true in whole societies. Today, in this room, people who are, after all, not really moderns, you all live in at least the last 9 months in a atmosphere where nobody who was born after 1400 even counts. If you're not a Rishon, you don't even exist here. Like, we're all friends of the Rambam, and the Ramban, and the Ravid, etc. In this room, if all of a sudden we heard this squeaky noise coming from the shtender over here, and somebody would suggest that there's apparently a shade in the shtender, so you wouldn't argue with me. You wouldn't say, well, you know, one squeaky noise does not a demon prove. You just laugh. It's not an acceptable explanation for funny noises. You know, funny noises are caused by other things. They might be caused by aliens. There are people who could live with that, but not by demons. For some reason, aliens are acceptable today and not demons, at least if you live in either Arizona or Haifa. But it just you just can't talk about it. Peter Berger wrote a book in his later mode called The Hint of Angels or The Echo of Angels, where he said after 40 years of claiming what's called secularization, which I will now speak about, that our society is just, there's certain things you can't talk about. We don't talk about demons, we don't talk about angels. You can talk about God if you don't mean it too much, but they just, you know, demons and angels don't exist. So you want to show, oh, you know, we were wrong. We misinterpreted society. There's this underlying religious, sacred basis to Western society which hasn't been stamped out by secularism. After all, and then he wrote a whole book about that thing. The sociology of knowledge cuts both ways. It cuts against us and it cuts for us. It cuts against everybody. On the one hand, it is true that if you're brought up in a certain atmosphere, you accept as true certain basic things. So let's say the people in this room were mostly brought up to a certain extent. I mean, you were from the Western society, but you were brought up in a closed Orthodox Jewish society. So there are things which the next block they think are funny, and you just think they're true because, you know, you just accept it. If you've been brought up in India, you presumably think otherwise. So that's something which actually disturbs us. So that we're familiar with this in one way or another. And I think everybody here has probably asked himself one time or another the question, you know, like, sure, I believe in this, but I know as a fact that had I been brought up in India, or for that matter in California, or in China, I would undoubtedly have very different beliefs. And you know, what could possibly convince me to believe in Torah and HaShemayim? Now that's true. You know, to a certain extent, the obvious, the Torah and HaShemayim is obvious only because we've heard it a million times. But of course it cuts the other way as well. People who don't believe in Torah and HaShemayim, people who don't think that it's possible, they're not, which is most people, you know, like it's just, like what could possibly be, make something like Torah and HaShemayim true? It's just, it's an event which just isn't acceptable in most areas of our discourse. That's also sociology of knowledge. It cuts in both directions. So basically, there are a whole slew of assumptions and beliefs and thoughts and thought patterns which we have, which are based in the society in which we live. Now, we happen to live in two somewhat discontinuous societies. Basically, in terms of society of knowledge, we're living in Western society much more than we're living in Jewish society. Because it's under the radar. Now, as we know, we taught in school, we taught to A, B, and C, but how to think and what does it mean to think scientifically, what does it mean to think logically, we're much more influenced by the general society than we are by a couple of years we spent learning Gemara. But we live in two societies, and there's a big disconnect between them, and that's exactly what I want to talk about. Like, where does the disconnect exist, and we should be at least be aware of it. I'm not telling you today what you should believe in. It's obviously I think you should believe it. But what I'm trying to point out is you should be aware as to how much of what influences the opinions that we accept and don't accept is due to things which are not really justifiable. They're simply accepted. The way people think, they need to be evaluated. They might be good, they might be bad, they might be good to some extent. But in any event, none of them are simply axioms. Axioms in the medieval sense were things which the truth could not be denied. Modern philosophy actually doesn't believe that any of those things exist. But once upon a time, the Rambam could list 25 axioms before Chelek Bet Amor Nevuchim. Euclid could have 10 axioms of geometry. So part of modern thought is that there aren't any axioms at all. But there are millions of axioms which aren't philosophically listed as axioms, but they're sociologically listed as axioms. They're just things which, you know, this could be true, this is true, and this cannot be true. So I want to examine specifically. So far I've thought of three, and I won't get to all three today. Three axioms of modern Western life which are very, very important and influence our ability to operate as Ovdei Hashem and Maminei HaTorah in the Western world. Okay, the order is somewhat arbitrary, and there must have been a reason why I ordered it this way, but that's very psychology, so who knows. A. One of the most impressive, I say it is impressive, and definitely most influential aspects of modern Western society, I will call it a name, we'll have to explain what it means because it's easy enough to give names, is individualism. And by that I mean a few things. And basically it means it's a davar pashut in Western society today, and this is something which is really different between Western society and other non-Jewish societies. It's not true in most of the world, but it's true in most of the world that you'll be moving around for the next couple of years, is that the unit of value is the single individual. His life is what matters. Things which contribute to my existence are good, things which inhibit my existence are bad, and almost everything else is weighted. Any other decision I make is weighted on that basis. This has to do with a lot of things. It has to do with, first of all, something which is, I don't want to talk about it, it's less crucial, though I think Judaism has a different opinion. It has to do it's an important issue in the United States. It has to do with politics. In other words, what is the relative value of the individual as opposed to the group, the community, or the state? Till 80 years ago, you could be a distinguished professor of philosophy in a Western university, and you could claim that the value of the individual derives from his membership in the nation or the group. Since World War II, you cannot be a distinguished professor in any Western university and claim that, because that's the philosophy that underlies fascism. And fascism is equivalent to Nazism, and therefore it is bad. It's obviously bad. But, and therefore, what sounds like an interesting philosophic question no longer exists. I'm not interested in talking about politics today. I think we have to talk about things which are more close to us as individuals. But there is a constant, you know, certain tension involved in that, because that's one of the differences between being liberal and being conservative, at least in the United States. Liberals are only about the value of the individual. Conservatives theoretically agree that the individual is what counts, but they have this instinctive feeling that church, community, my membership in the community is something that's important. If you don't have it, it's going to be a bad thing. But the official Western philosophy, it's found in the Declaration of Independence, more or less, says that the rights and the value of the individual are paramount. Everything else is measured by that. Now, this has to do with, I'll mention a few nafkaminas. This has to do with, this is a famous thing in philosophy of law today, the difference between rights and duties. And it's an obvious difference. It's not as simplistic as it sounds, but it's an obvious difference between all of Western law and halacha. All of Western law starts with the rights of the individual. Society, since the time, this is not so modern, this is since the time of Locke, society exists in order to protect the rights of the individual. All laws are measured by whether or not they can be justified by to how much they impugn on the rights of the individual. Halacha, it is a vote, but it's true, halacha is not a rights-based system, but a duties-based system. And Judaism is a philosophy that's based on a duties-based system and not on a rights-based system. It's not as if the Torah was given in order to give you rights. The Torah was given in order to tell you what to do, in order because you have duties to other people, to God, to yourself. But now, obviously there's a connection between the two. If you have a right under American law, then I have a duty to not infringe it. And if I have a duty to help you, then you have a right to get help from me. But there's a big difference where you start from. There's a big difference what you expect. And there's a big difference, let's say, in the neutral case. If I see somebody who's a schlub, he doesn't do anything. He doesn't contribute to society. He just sits around, drinks beer, and watches television. So how do we view him? In all honesty, I'm being a little bit exaggerated, but under the economic and philosophic and legal system that exists in the United States of America and in all other Western countries, he's an outstanding citizen. I may not admire him. I think he could do more with his life, but he doesn't have to do more with his life. You know, I have no great expectation. When you were younger, your teacher told you that, you know, you should aspire to become somebody really great, especially in the United States. Michael Jordan, when I was younger, they said you should win a Nobel Prize in physics, but I don't think they tell that anymore. But that was still fourth or fifth grade. You know, like, once you get to high school, then, you know, your parents would like you to be a doctor. They would like you to be a lawyer. But basically, that's all secondary to, you have a right to sit around and do nothing. You know, you're not allowed to steal. If the only way you can maintain your existence as a couch potato is to steal from other people, then you have a problem. Because they have a right not to give you their money. But if you've worked out a way to live off air, or to live off your inheritance, or you found a way to actually, if people will pay you, to write reviews of the television shows you watch, that's one of the highest aspirations of your typical American male. You know, like, it depends what you like, but like, imagine the awful lot of people in the United States who would give anything to get paid to be a food critic. You know, what is a food critic? It's a person who's paid to eat and then give comments about it. You know, what are your comments? Your comments have to be interesting. You can't just say it was tasteless or it was tasty. You have to say it reminded me of the taste of chicken fat fried rubber. That makes you a food critic. It's a great job. Because people have spent 50, 60 years. I have to admit, I read the New York Times. Clay Craborn has been the food critic for the New York Times for the last 50 years. He celebrated his anniversary yesterday. He got a whole special spread. Spread in many more, in Tati Mashma. People would love that. That's your right, you know. And you don't have to contribute anything. You just have to find a way to keep going. If you've managed to make just an example. These examples are going through my head. And the people who sold YouTube to Google for $1.2 billion, I believe. So they're actually the same people who previously had invented eBay. No, they invented PayPal, which they sold for $300 million to eBay. So of the three people who had invented PayPal, two went on to invent YouTube, and one went to get his master's degree in university. And so there's an article about this when they sold the two people. I was pointing out the article. They said these two guys, they understand, but what's with this guy? Like he it's true. He had 300. He got a third of that. He had $100 million in the bank, but you know, I mean, so. You know, he said, I have $100 million. You know, like, now I want to go. I want to study something. I want to learn something. There are other things to do in life. And, like, you know, people find that really amazing. Like, why didn't the guy just, you know, do YouTube? Like, he could have made another $400 million, which then he could have used to, well, a lot of things you could do with $400 million. He could have donated a lot of it to Yeshiva Tahar Etzion, and then he really would have been a positive person. But since he's doing what he is doing anyhow, it's really hard to understand. A person has a right to anything he wants. If he wants to make something of his life, he can do that. If he wants to sit at home, he can do that. That's Yisodi. That is American law. That is constitutional law. The Constitution gives you the right to do absolutely nothing. And nobody can come and say anything. The only thing today, it took a little while before it developed. This has been going on for 200 years, but in the last 30 years, we've discovered that the only thing that's illegal in the United States is to harm other people. And that explains all the great Supreme Court cases of the last 40 years. Because there were laws on the books which said this is not good, this is not moral, this doesn't contribute to society, and then they said, but so what? Like, what's the issue? The only issue left in the United States is to harm other people. Occasionally, because the people are gaonim, they're really bright, they can figure out a way to ask for something with pilpul. It'll hurt somebody somehow. And basically those laws, you have to be a Catholic to say something like that, and today there happens to be a Catholic majority in the United States Supreme Court, so those things still stand, a few of them, but they'll disappear eventually, because the only thing that's really illegal is to hurt other people. So that's like one aspect of individualism. The unit of value is a human being, and then I measure like what he's worth. What he's worth is his rights. That's why he has rights and not duties. He only has those duties which are created by the rights of other people. I don't have to explain this. It's obvious that halacha begins with what you have to do, not what's magia lacha. How many psukim in the Torah all explain that you could expect that something is, you're going to get something. You're going to get something. If you behave properly, you'll get maybe a reward. Right? The whole thing is based on the fact that you exist in a structure which requires you to, first of all, to serve God. You exist only to serve God. You exist as an Eved Hashem, otherwise you wouldn't exist at all. I'm going to put a little drush to make it even more clear, since we're shortly after Pesach. The story of Pesach says that Am Yisrael, they were naturally slaves, and they were freed by Kadosh Baruch Hu in order to serve God. Sher hotzeiticha me'eretz Mitzrayim Liot Li Avadim. Those who have gotten to Daf Dalet in Brachot and have read Rabbeinu Yonah Ala Makom, he quotes the pasuk to explain why we daven. As opposed to those who think that coming out of an obviously American Jewry and American non-Jewry likes the story of Pesach because the story of freedom, etc., which it is, the story of freedom, but it's a very particular kind of freedom. It's not the freedom of simply getting out of slavery, it's the freedom of going to Hasina. The important thing is the natural state. The natural state is slavery. Freedom is created in the context of serving. In other words, the definition of a free person is one who serves a higher calling than the master next door. If you don't serve power, but you serve God, then you're free. If you don't serve power and you don't serve anybody, that's not even considered a possibility within the story of the Torah. If you're not serving anybody, then you'll be serving power. Then you'll sink into slavery. Because slavery is the natural state of human beings. I think once quoted this, it's part of my doing Chazara now. One of the founding statements of Western political thought is the line by Rousseau, man is everywhere born free and is everywhere found in chains. Whereas the Torah says the other way around. He's Jews. He certainly means about man as well. Man is born in chains, and on very rare and special occasions, based on a continuing relationship with God and working very hard to keep it up, he can achieve some measure of freedom. So that's an extreme example. You know, I just said now the Jewish is very, very extreme. It says that if you're not all the time serving God, then you're a slave. But what's obviously true is that you exist in order to serve. So you can serve God, you can serve Amisoy, you can serve your neighbors, you can serve, you might even be able to serve yourself in a higher sense. But you exist to serve. Adam la'amal yulad. Man is born in order to do things, to work at something, not in order to exist. Now, the idea that human existence is the basis for value, this is one point of something which we talked about at length, and I think it's a very, very nice point, is in fact based on Judaism. To say that the single individual is the ultimate measure of value is based on the concept of Tzedem Elokim. Because otherwise, why is a human life different than a dog life? Why is human being the ultimate measure of value? It's just an economic or organic organism. It's based on the fact that human life, it's infinite value, to use a Jewish term, which maybe people who still use those words might use outside of a Jewish context. It's surely ultimate value. You know, a really good movie ends and begins with either a birth or a death, because that's something which can't be measured. It's either an infinite loss or an infinite birth. That is pure Tzedem Elokim. Without Tzedem Elokim, you have a very great difficulty defending that. And since the truth is, we'll get this another time, but since modern society isn't so into Tzedem Elokim, so they're going to have trouble defending their own humanistic values. But what I pointed out, we talked about Tzedem Elokim at length, is why Tzedem Elokim is not the basis for this description. Because Tzedem Elokim in Yiddishkeit doesn't say that you have the value of God, but says you have the potential value of God. And that is a total difference of black and white. If human beings are little gods, then each human being is the value. But if when I say that you have Tzedem Elokim, it means that you could achieve totally transcendent value, more than anything else in the world, and that does give you value now, but only because you're on that track. If someone would get off that track, he says, I am Elokim, but not Tzedem Elokim, then the halachic response is, Bohidim velo ma'alim, very unlivable thing, then you can kill him. And that's called, he's a min in the kofer. He's an obed of Arizal. The value is achieved, not because you are the value. If you're a couch potato, you're doing nothing, then there's no value there. When I take and then I talk about cameras. If I take a picture of any one of you in the room, but surely of this fellow who's doing nothing, the picture, the still, shows an animal. It shows some molecules. It shows some biological processes. You have to see where he's going to realize that there is infinite value here. What happened in modern society, they took the historical Jewish idea of Tzedem Elokim, the thousands of years of slowly beginning to value human beings. It's true, 2,000 years ago, so the average society thought of human beings as being dirt. And you could just, you just threw them out. So eventually, through the influence of Judaism, later on Christianity, so they began to value human beings. And eventually, you strip off the religious background, you strip off God, and you're left only with the Tzedem, but without the Elokim. And what do you get? You say, well, this human being is the highest value I know. And you measure everything by that. And that turns everything on its head. So instead of being value because I'm valuable because I am committed to something higher than me, I'm committed to imitating God, I'm committed to getting closer to God, that's what gives you my value, it becomes the exact opposite. You don't have value because you're committed, you have value because you exist. Because you were born. That's why you have value. And therefore, at least as far as you're concerned, your value is that you can get anything you want. You have to be careful for other people not to step on their values in terms of themselves as well. So I mentioned here two examples. They're related. One is rights and duties. The other is I mentioned three things. One, I mentioned individual versus community. Two, rights versus duties. Three, what do you measure? Does your rights, your existence, is that the way I measure everything? It's called humanism. I measure everything by that, or do I have some other method of measuring it? And I want to just connect it to the first point I made. In any normal discussion outside of this room, outside of this space medrash, outside of a place where it's natural to use, I don't mean because you open the windows, we talk a different language here. If you have to speak in the language of people who are not in this room, whether Jewish or not Jewish, in the university or in books or in the pages of the New York Times, it's obvious, it's not debatable that the value of the individual is what everything rises and falls on. If you read the arguments, this is about, for 40 years it's been a topic, about abortion in the United States. Both sides of the question, outside of reading what the Pope's encyclical, but once you get to non-purely Catholic religious writings, the question is whether or not the baby has a right to live. There's almost no discussion as to whether or not mothers have a duty to foster their children's life. It begins with that a person has a right over her own body. That's a double muskam. And then you have to say, oh, but that's true, but maybe there are two bodies here. And that's where the whole thing comes down to the question of when does life begin. But if you would concede the point that the embryo is not an independent human being, then the discussion is over in the United States. Because, of course, a woman has a right over her own body. It's her body. If you tell them that there's a Mishnah of a Kama that says that you're not allowed to cut yourself, that's laughable in modern society. It's one of those quaint things about Judaism. It's like saying you're not allowed to eat chazer. You know, there are these ancient taboos. Why can't the person put a hole in their own body? It's his body. Do anything he wants. No one disagrees with that. It's not a starter. You can say, well, in the end, what you can do is, because you're a firm person, you say, okay, I understand your argument, but we have this Issa. So they say, okay, you can obey the Issa, but you're not allowed to impose it on others. But to say that you think that society or human beings have a duty to protect other human beings on different degrees, I have to help my neighbor, but someone who was stuck in me, I have to help them more, it doesn't exist in the literature, and I read the literature, it doesn't exist. It hasn't been mentioned. You know, the Pope wrote it in Latin in the encyclical on abortion, and it's in Latin. You know, it stays in Latin. It's like writing in Aramaic. It makes a lot of sense if you lived 2,000 years ago, but it doesn't make any sense today at all. Now, again, there's no logical reason for that. I'm pointing out that it's the kind of discourse that we have in modern society, that you can only argue on that basis. And I wouldn't even suggest, I'm not trying to tell anybody here that, oh, what Ezra Bick is saying is that when next time you have an argument with somebody about abortion, so you should tell them that you have duties. They won't understand you. I'm not even sure you'd understand you. It's not the way we talk once we get out of this room. I'm just telling you, you should be aware of that. That halacha is based on something else entirely. It's based on all of us have obligations all the time to support all sorts of people. Parents have to support their children. Mothers have to support their embryos. Children have to support their parents. You have to support your neighbor. Different levels of support. It's a whole system based on how much of an obligation you have. What's the obligation? Which is in your body. The original mashal in this particular case was the story of the boat. The person says he wants to drill a hole in the robot that's underneath this thing. So that was an idea to show you why you can't sell your boat, because you can do anything you want with your own body, but it's not your body, you're in a boat. It's a very famous mashal. It was definitely in the literature 40, 50 years ago. I haven't seen it in years. No one even talks about that anymore. So again, I'm saying it's one example. This is something which, just imagine, saying you have an argument, you wouldn't argue on those bases. You do the right way now. The whole thing in the United States is to find a way, the impossible decision to, it's a really difficult question to answer, is what's the legal or moral or philosophic definition of the start of human life? And it's a question which you cannot prove one way or the other, therefore it's a good thing to argue about, because you know that you can always say anything you want. But to say that people have to take care, there was a movement recently, occasionally there are setbacks to modern thought. So there was a movement recently, there was a case, I think in Cleveland, where they threw a woman into jail for smoking while she was pregnant. Since smoking is bad for the embryo, they've proven that the average, if a mother smokes while she's pregnant, so the kid is born, he weighs 3.2 ounces less than the average kid who doesn't, and has all sorts of implications. He'll be stupider. Amazingly enough, there really is a study like that. If your mother smoked when you were pregnant, then you're stupid. I think we could save a lot of money in yeshiva if we just, instead of giving bechinos, we would just check to see if the mother smoked or not. So they actually put a woman in jail. It was one of these, you know, right-wing Republican district attorneys. They stuck her in jail. So, of course, the Supreme Court's banner. I have to agree. In fact, it's a limit to what you can tell people to do. But it was really an amazing case because, you know, she was out of smoke. I mean, how can you tell people they're not out of smoke? So the fact that she's pregnant, she has an obligation to change her whole life because it will affect... Sure, there's a case where it does affect somebody else, you know, so it sort of could be brought into American law. But it seemed to be extremely excessive. I mean, I'm not allowed to smoke because maybe it'll... And frankly, you know, those are the arguments whether you're allowed to smoke in public even. But, you know, I'm smoking. How does it affect other people? It's their problem, so I'm going to go someplace else. You know, the constant refrain, you know, it's a free country, I can do anything I want as long as I don't actually trample you. Okay, so that is one area. So I mentioned this unit of value, rights versus duties, individual versus the tzibur. I think the most important question really is the one I said is the unit of value, because that affects everything we do. Forgetting about that, I gave too many examples from law. The examples are more important in terms of your own life. How disappointed is a person with himself if he's not in service to a higher ideal? I don't think I have to convince anybody that, you know, Yiddishkeit is based on that you are in service to a higher ideal. It's putting it in the most non-divine way I can. I didn't mention the name God. I just said a higher ideal. And obviously there's a tremendous weight of the history of Western culture that agrees with that. But the weight is dissipating. Basically, in Western culture today, if you want to just shrug that off, I don't have to answer to anybody, you know. Okay, as long as I'm not killing somebody, so what if I'm not better than I could be, more productive than I could be? You could do the same argument in the areas that have nothing to do with Yiddishkeit or value, you know. Like the whole theory, Max Weber and others, that the reason why America became great was because Protestants founded America, and the Protestant ethic had nothing to do with God. It's just, we said that if you work, you're a good person. If you don't work, you're a bad person. There were laws in the United States that if you're not working, they put you in jail for not working. They don't care which body you had. You weren't allowed to be a batlan. Yeshiva has a similar law, but they don't enforce it. Some yeshivas do, but not this one. It's a shame. The mashkichim here are very laid back. Basically, they're lazy. Otherwise, we would give malchus to batlanim. But Protestants in Massachusetts, the Puritans, we put you in a stock for being indolent. For not working. So Max Weber claimed that's what made America great. That was called capitalism and the Protestant ethic. It doesn't exist today anymore. It existed as a little bit of a sub thing. But someone gets up and says, I don't care to do anything. I don't have to produce. Okay, there's no answer to that question. And I think we're all infected by it. I suggest everybody in this room is infected by it. You know, your parents want you to do good things. Maybe you'd like to do good things because you'd like to have a lot of money, perhaps. But how guilty do you feel that you didn't learn more? How guilty did you feel that you're not a better person? How guilty do you feel that you're not doing something, that you're not subscribing to, you're not volunteering someplace, that you're not serving? You're not doing things for others, for something greater, as opposed to how disappointed or how do I feel, wow, I could have had more fun. You know, that's something which we're upset about. But that I have to serve others, that's, maybe I think it's a chiyuv. I'm not talking about chiyuv in that. We're firm people, so now we have a chiyuv. If someone comes to my door, I have to give him a tzedakah. But I view that as being an imposition. You know, I could have been doing something useful. I could be reading a book. But what kind of, I accept that I have an obligation. But I'm quite about whether the unit of value here, that a life that's not in service, that a life that's not serving an ideal is a useless life. It's a tzelem elokim that's not b'shevut elokim, and therefore it's nothing. It's just a hunk of thing. That's something which you have to really work on to remember, even though it's clear that Yiddishkeit is based on it. And that's a major difference between being a Western individual and being a member of Kahal Hashem, being a member of Knesset Yisrael Sheoved Et Hashem. Okay? Yeah.
Wouldn't you say that there's a strong value of being a citizen in America? That's it.
Well, much stronger than in other countries. That's true.
Schools, for instance, have student government and sanity. I mean, I'm struck when I went to America with that kind of the model thing.
It's 100% true. It's also disappearing. You know, there are different levels of communal responsibility. It is true that Biyusodo in the 18th century America was based very strongly on community. Tocqueville wrote a whole book about it. He claimed that's what made America different than any other country in the world, and he was right. And there are a dozen books that have written in the last 30 years pointing out that how it's disappearing. So you know, there's a certain tradition of weight, and there's a clash, not just by us, there's a clash between traditional Anglo-Saxon, in this case, culture and modernity does not particularly value the belonging to a club. Okay, if you take American movies, if the movie is about a guy who belongs to, there's a book about it, I don't know what it's called. There's a book, a guy, some sociologist wrote a whole book examining bowling clubs in America. What's it called? Yeah, I didn't read it. I just do these things because I read the summary of the review in the Sunday review of reviews. You know, I'm able to talk intellectually. Okay, if you make a movie today and one of the characters belongs to a bowling club, so we are now going to limit the those who don't belong to this actual group, but can imagine they do because you really do in your heart. Okay. New Yorkers, which when I was a child meant all of American Jewry, New Yorkers understand that it's a movie about not a hero, okay? Yeah, the hero is living in New York City, doesn't belong to anything, doesn't go to church, doesn't go to shul, doesn't belong to a club, doesn't, you know, he's living his life in pursuit of whatever. There's a big difference between Seinfeld and any other thing. That's by definition. Now it's true that it still exists in America, but it's basically disappearing. It's not important. The numbers are down. The numbers are way down. And some people complain about it. They point out that there's a lot of value to it, whatever. But there's no question that very few students in elite American universities, like for instance Harvard or Yeshiva University, are members of social clubs. In Harvard and Yale, you remember that club which allows you to look down at other people, skulls and bones, but not a club that does things, you know, like not a club that actually has any purpose other than just giving you a feeling of superiority. And so, no, it is true. I'm not familiar with the statistics or the exact basis, but it's a well-known commonplace that the reason why America is a more successful country than other countries, more successful than say European countries, is exactly because of the survival of community-based obligations and feelings, civic duty. But that's my point. Civic duty is a dying, even civic. I'm talking about religious duty. Civic duty. My commitment to my community. To pick up the garbage. If I walk in the street and I see litter, do I pick it up? That's like civic duty. So it's 200 years ago, Americans would do that. At least where I come from in America, nobody would dare do that. I mean, it's also to bend over to pick up garbage in New York City because it allows, makes it easier for the guy behind you to stab you. So, you know, it's dying out. And maybe that's why America's not great anymore. I don't know. But, well, it's a good point. When I'm interested in statistics, I'm interested in the weight of cultural discourse, which doesn't really justify it. You know, there's no particular reason why. There are people who do it, but if you don't do it, there's nothing wrong with you. There's surely nothing wrong with not doing it. And if you waste the time on it, helping other people and something like that, you consider it to be some sort of a buffoon or a hobo or something like that. You know, belonging to societies which even things which are obvious to us that are good. And a lot of Americans belong to societies which distribute food to the homeless. All that. I'm not sure how respected it is. You know, it's respected in your church. It's not necessarily respected in, I don't think it's respected in Yale. It's an interesting thing to waste time by spending a lot of time helping people stop. There was the guy's an Israeli. There's an Israeli who taught a course at Harvard. He's now back in Israel. He taught a course at Harvard 3-4 years ago, which turned out to be the most popular course in the history of Harvard. He had,
like,
1,200 students in his classroom. It was a psychology course. It was called the Psychology of Happiness. All psych courses are about people who are sick. So he didn't invent this. There's a professor who taught him this, that we should do the psychology of healthy people, not the psychology of sick people. And so they did all sorts of investigations, what makes people happy and satisfied. I'm not sure happiness and satisfaction is a Jewish ideal, but let's take it fake diet as a good thing. And so what he tried to show them was that, you know, doing what you normally do in college doesn't necessarily make you happy. So you told me the first week was find a project to help somebody and then write about it. So that they felt very satisfied. They felt much better because they went and they cleaned up the park or they helped a homeless person. You know, like but it was a big chiddush. Like, he tried to convince the students that if you spend less time at booze parties on Saturday nights and more time helping people, you'll actually be happier. There's scientific theories which are trying to determine why that's true, because we all know that it doesn't make sense. But they have theories explaining why it's true. And anyway, he's not teaching in Harvard anymore, so that just shows you how far you can get by trying to tell people to be decent human beings. But there is a problem. I don't deny it. Again, nothing. I don't think one time this in the last 6 months did I talk about happiness. I can't help it. Like, you know, the Rav so many times told us that Judaism makes you miserable and unhappy that I find it difficult to argue. But there is something to the other theory as well. I think it is true that if you're closer to the Kadosh Baruch Hu, that is the way God made man. It's that God was created with Tzelem Elokim. So I think it should make you feel good. Not always, but I'm not surprised that it does. You know, normal human Yetzer, I even say the word Rav, just Yetzer, tells you that feeling happy might be important to give stuff, but feeling happy is connected to eating, drinking, and other things that one can do when one goes to college. And you should also do mitzvahs if you have a chance. That's one value. I talk philosophy. The modernism is definitely individual values. One of the results is a weakening of communal values. Weakening. You can measure it in all different ways. It's only weakening in the meantime. But the philosophy isn't the weakening. The philosophy is very, very deliberate. When you talk logically, when you talk philosophically, when you argue about something, then you have to come back. Somehow you can probably claim that maybe strengthening communal values will also strengthen my individualism. But you can't have an argument. You can't talk to somebody and say that, no, so what? But it's not good for individuals. Individuals have to limit themselves. You can't say that. Individuals don't have to limit themselves. You can make an argument that if we all limit ourselves a little bit, then we'll all gain in the end. That's a typical governmental article. You know, we don't. You have to pay taxes. That's a limitation, but in the end, you get it back. But you don't have to limit yourself just because you have to limit yourself. You have to limit yourself because it's good for you. In other words, you gain in the end. You have to measure the gain to the individual human being, whether it's in politics, law, individual decisions, society, yeshiva. I'm not sure when I said yeshiva. What yeshiva do you pick? You pick the yeshiva that gives you the most. Presumably, I hope that's why you chose yeshiva. But something wrong with that, but that's just another example. You know, like you go to the place which gives you the most for what you want. And if you want A, you go to this yeshiva, you want B, you go to that yeshiva. But that's your God given right. You don't have, I mean, it's true in this case. You don't have an obligation to go to this yeshiva, any other yeshiva. You just go to what's best for you. Isn't that what when you were in seniors in high school, isn't that what all the advisors told you? You know, go to the college or the university or the yeshiva or whatever, that's best for you. There's a million books and a million movies which come to tell us you don't do what your parents want, you don't do what society expects from you, you do what's really good for you. And if it turned out that it's not so good to go to college for 4 years, maybe you should go and bum around the Far East for 2 years and discover yourself. That's minor side. Nothing wrong with that, I'm in favor, personally. But you have to be aware that's not what Judaism is based on. Okay, I want to mention one other topic which we'll just start and because it's really complicated, and we'll discuss more next week. The first topic was individualism. Second topic is secularism. That's an obvious point. Any book about modernity starts with secularism. What does secularism mean? Secularism means that in terms of society, we don't have... secularism is not the same as anti-religion. We sometimes use it that way, you know, because we, in Yiddishkeit, we talk about religious people and secular people. But because if you're a secular person, you're probably not doing mitzvahs. But that's not what it means. There are many religious secularists in America. Secularism is a theory of society and of politics, which says that the things which we are allowed to take into consideration in public life are purely secular. They don't involve entities which are based on kedusha. Now, for instance, it's not necessarily... This is a complicated question because it could be that we have something to learn here. In politics, which doesn't concern us personally at the moment, but in politics, secularism means separation of church and state. It was a major revolution in Europe, whereas once the church was in the fabric of the state, the political state, so gradually, some places more, some places less, the church is taken out of the political realm. Religion, God, and the church are not part of the political realm. Technically, that means disestablishmentism. The church is not actually a government arm. And then it raises other things as to what sort of values, what sort of discourse, what sort of pressure one is allowed to put. So America's on one side of the spectrum. European countries are less politically less secular. They're sociologically more secular, but politically less secular. I'm just giving an example because I'm not sure that's a bad thing. I'm pretty sure it's a good thing. It is true that if you look at the Makavas, traditional Jewish society was also not a secular society. I mean, you know, the Navi, the Kohen Gadol, the the Rav, I mean, they had positions. There's a long historical basis of Shelley said that wasn't necessarily a good thing. And it's not necessarily true that the state has to be involved in religion, or religion has to be involved in the state. That's one aspect of secularism. But secularism is much more than just a political theory. Secularism involves all society. What you do in your house, you can do anything you want. If you have God living in your house, that's your power. But when you walk into the street and you meet other people, when I deal with somebody else, so that's not a consideration. That's secularism in its widest sense. Obviously, you know, Judaism is a society. It's not just me and my God. As a society, God is part of it. Like, when I walk in the street, so, you know, three Jews meet, the Shekhinah Beinayim. That's part of the way I see society works. So then we have to see, like, what does it mean? Like, how does secularism affect the fact that, you know, that modern West society is overwhelmingly secularist in its public areas? A lot of religious people in West society, especially in the States, at least 10% of the people in Britain still go to church on Sundays. So there are some non-religious people in other countries as well. But society, the street, is rampantly secular. You're not allowed to flaunt, to bring religion to affect the way once I leave the Dalet Amos. There was a line, it's a famous line because it's in Hebrew, said, but it was said by a man who really wasn't from me. I can't really hide it, but he pretended to be from me. It was 150 years ago. One of the great founders of modern Jewish culture. Actually, I don't know who it was. I don't think it was Petz, I think it was Yalag. Yud Lamed Gordon. He said, Heyei Yehudi beveitecha ve'adam betzeitecha. Of course you should be Shomer Shabbos in your house. But once you leave your own door, for instance, take, you know, Shabbos is not something which is public. You know, like, so once you leave your house, there are other people there, you know, like, the fact that you want to have a neighbor, if you want to do this, you want to do that, it's not appropriate. Society is by definition secular, which has certain historical reasons. It's healthy, it's good for them, but it also has it's also tfisat olam. It's also a way that I think about things. In other words, it affects things which have nothing to do with society. If I have to explain, okay, the example I brought before about the demons in the thing, if I have to explain to myself why the sun is shining, why it rains, I have to pick a policy. You know, like, I would like to have more crops. I want my crops to grow. What do I do? There are two explanations how to get crops to grow better. There are two methods how to get crops to grow better. One is called fertilizer. The other is called prayer. Historically, more people believe in the second than in the first. But secularization means that, okay, I really believe that prayer will help. But practically speaking, you can hear somebody speaking this way, the word practically speaking. You know, I think you should pray. But practically speaking, you have to put down fertilizer. Now, lest no one doubt for a second, I really think you should put down fertilizer if you want your crops to grow. Unless you're one of those organic people and then you should put down something else. Maybe you should put down something. Okay? I really, you know, I don't think praying necessarily will work if you don't do anything else. But the question is, how do we understand, like, what takes place in the world outside of my heart? My heart is very religious. But is my house built? Do my crops grow? Does my company run? Is there anything, any place to think that? Are you allowed to use words which are drawn from spiritual life as opposed to other areas? Am I allowed to talk about my soul as opposed to my body? We'll talk about another area in the future, reductionism. And secularism is rampant in Western society. They haven't just taken the church out of the government. They've taken the church out of anything other than your heart. And the buildings are allowed to still stand. If you want to go there, you can go there. Obviously, Jewish society, maybe you can argue, I think you can argue as to if we will, how much do we want to have, should we have a religious party? Should we have the Navi? Should we have a Navi sitting next to the king? You can argue about those things. Do we really want this kind of society? But to say that Jewish society is not one that has Kedusha and God and mitzvahs in its fabric is impossible. And there's a conflict here, which you'll feel immediately once you decide about anything as to, like, how do I think about myself? How do I think about the way I live? How do I explain what's going on? Of course I want to do mitzvahs. Of course I want a good relationship with God. And it's a common note in modern Orthodox Modern Orthodox is a very unfortunate term because it implies that you could be modern and Orthodox. What I'm trying to discuss is it possible? Like, how modern can one be and still be Orthodox? But in modern Orthodoxy, it is a commonplace. I'm willing to guess that 80% of those from Shomer Shabbos Jews who consider themselves modern Orthodox don't genuinely believe that averus cause that mitzvahs cause good things. What did I change? Because even non-religious people think that averus cause bad things. Like when you have a disaster, you start looking around. But if you do well, right, if your stock went up yesterday, stock market dropped 3% yesterday. If your stock went up yesterday, so does anyone in Teaneck think that that was because they davened in the morning? Find it hard to believe. We have a secular attitude towards the. We have a secular attitude about the stock, about the stock exchange. Who gets elected to be president of the United States? It's obvious to a Jew that God picks the president of the United States. How many people in this room believe that? I think that God finagled the votes in Florida. I really do. But none of you think that way. If you vote and you get elected, you know, like, how could God possibly manage that? Does God really play games? And once you close the curtain in a voting booth, God can really change the results? It's simple. I mean, you don't even need a NACE. It's based on computers. All God has to do is go whoop, and another 1,000 votes. Again, but none of you think that God does things like that, because you're secular individuals. You think that God's very important to your life. You should daven to him. You should talk to him. You should pray to him. You should learn his Torah. You should do what he says. But you don't think that explains what's happening here. You don't think God explains what's going on. What explains what's going on is secular things, namely physics, science, economics, whatever. Global warming. Global warming is because you buy too many refrigerators and you burn coal. There is a connection, as far as I can tell. But does anyone? I'm a little old fashioned. I find it hard to believe anyone really thinks that something as big as global warming is being caused by human beings. You know, like, God wants to warm up the world. He'll warm up the world. He wants to cool off the world. He'll cool off the world. Like, what's the big deal here? Secularism affects everything we think about. And this is something we have to take one by one. There were good parts and there were bad parts. We'll talk about different issues when we come back next week within the topic of secularism. Then we'll talk about my third issue, which is reductionism. And then we'll know everything we need to know about living in the... What was this thing called 6 months ago? That topic that Rabbi Weber put down? Theology in the 21st century. Then we'll know everything we need to know about being Jews in the 21st... Basically, I'm talking about the 20th century, but... Because you don't... 20th century is old ancient history to you, so we'll call it the 21st century.
In American law, isn't like an earthquake or a typhoon still called an act of God?
In insurance law?
Yeah.
In your insurance
still referred to as an act of law?
Yes, it is.
Well, how do you explain that?
Anything that can't be stopped. It's, first of all, it's an insurance policy. It uses language, the legal language, which was invented in the 16th century by Grotius. So you can't change those things. It's not in English. It's written in legalese. But an act of God is something which you could not have prevented. It's not your fault.
Right. Therefore, why can't we call it something else, especially if society is so rabid?
No, also because of disasters. The truth is, when you have disasters, we know there are no, it's famous line, there are no atheists in a foxhole.
Right.
Great disasters bring God back into people's lives. Hurricane, what's it called? Katerina. Of course, when you said it, people got very upset. Implying that for some reason God had something against New Orleans.
That's what we're making a difference.